Shifting baselines.
Welcome to Shifting Baselines, a podcast on sustainability and club culture, dedicated to creating awareness, sharing knowledge, and diving into the complex relationship between the planet and raving. In this additional recording, researcher and initiator of Shifting Baselines, Kirsten Meisner, shares some thoughts on the background of her research-based podcast project in an interview with fellow researcher Cara Daggett. If you want to learn more about the project, please visit refugeworldwide.com/artists/shiftingbaselines.
Hi.
Hi.
So nice to have you, Cara. I'm happy to have this conversation with you about the thoughts behind the podcast and how it came about. And before we start, it would be great if you could introduce yourself to the listeners. So who are you?
So my name is Cara New Daggett, and I met Kirsten, you, this year at the Research Institute for Sustainability. And I'm here from Virginia Tech, where I am a professor in the Department of Political Science. And I study the politics of energy, but in a way that usually surprises most people who study energy, because I take a feminist and historical perspective. So I got to know you through our little group we formed on queer ecologies. And I've been hearing about this podcast, and it's a beautiful thing to have finally heard it, and I can't wait to hear more.
I'm so happy you agreed on having this conversation in the form of an interview. So as you said, my name is Kirsten. I'm the creative producer and researcher and curator of this podcast project as part of my fellowship at the RIFS, the Research Institute for Sustainability. And I'm very happy you agreed on being part of this, because I really value your work, and especially for all of you who don't know Cara's work, it's very worth checking it out.
With any big project and any question or idea, you know, always start with the hardest part, which is how are you even going to conceptualize this, or what medium are you going to use to talk about this? So I wondered if you could tell us about the genesis of this idea. Why bring together club culture and sustainability, and why make it a podcast?
So my personal interest very much relates or translates into my academic interest, but let me start maybe with the personal first. I would say I'm linked to dance floor since a very young age. I always danced when I was a teenager, started to go out. I grew up in a political environment, early 90s, post-wall, post-GDR context in Germany, and grew up being surrounded by a lot of like very difficult political energies, like a lot of right-wing extremism, the so-called Baseballschlägerjahre, which is also a term in the German discourse. And we had a very active youth culture. We had a youth center where there was a sound system, there was a central location for hardcore music. We had a lot of concerts, a lot of music events going on. So that's how I grew up being a teenager, where my interest in music and sound and going out was always linked to also the political side of the relevance of these spaces to come together, to be connected. And fast forward, I'm in Berlin since almost 20 years, and I've experienced a lot of changes within the rave scene. I find the dance floor a very relevant social space, and again, for me personally, but also on a social and political level. And my research interest is always kind of focusing on the intersection of culture, social political theory, and activism in a way. Questions of how did things become the way they are and how can they be different? And I applied for the fellowship and was accepted with that idea to not just look at dance floors as these spaces for joy and hedonism and switching off, but also for engagement and maybe becoming a political subject in a way, or becoming aware of certain things, because concepts like awareness, harm reduction play a big role, especially within queer nightlife. And linking it to sustainability, how we think about climate crisis, there are certain topics that are really in the foreground, such as travel, emissions of spaces, like the built surroundings. But then there's the immateriality or the perceived immateriality of data and digitalization, and streaming is so relevant for music consumption and the music industry. And I find also very relevant to address that we are in the planetary crisis with our bodies. We are embodied beings. We are sensing beings. And to address that and think about the dance floor as a space to possibly connect with our emotions. Yeah, also with maybe difficult emotions. It seemed like a very convincing storyline without wanting to create a linearity. Why have I chosen a podcast format? The main reason is I love the idea of accessing storytelling, research, different forms of knowledge production in a very like mobile way. I love podcast as a storytelling format. I've chosen a very like storytelling kind of approach where it's less about me representing research and talking with people and recording these interviews, but rather finding or connecting with people from within the culture who are already, in the case of the curators, active as in writing about topics, talking about topics, or practicing certain aspects that I found relevant within that research.
Yeah, it really feels like a feminist and queer question, research question, because it is taking seriously everyday life, the body, what's happening between people in spaces that are often thought of as private or somehow external to policy making. But you're taking it seriously as a political space, even, I've heard you say, an ecosystem. So can you say a little bit about this idea that the dance floor or the club scene is an ecosystem?
That's a term I find really relevant to understand how things are connected. And I very much in my own work always take a relational approach. So I don't see things as isolated entities, you know, just something that is just there, but something that's embedded in how we connect with it, the policies around it, the discourse around it, how we talk about things, how we feel. Talking about rave culture as an ecosystem also implies there is not such a thing as the club culture. It is a space where you might meet your friends or where you just like go to switch off. At the same time, it links to a big private industry sector. So it's very commercialized. Within the COVID pandemic, the revenues of electronic dance music as an industry grew about, like, I think from 8.4 to 11.2 billion. There is a merge between techno and TikTok. It's very popular at the moment. It's also a consumerist culture. And it's also a public space where, especially in a city like Berlin, it has a lot to do with the building regulations. It ties into discourses on gentrification. It also is connected to the question of, do clubs need or want public funding? Is it important to access that? What does it mean if the state can actually enter club spaces? There's also another layer. Looking at rave culture as an ecosystem, it's not just the ravers, the promoters, the DJs, the bar personnel, the cleaners, like the punters or the door people, you also have the membranes of the speakers. You have the dust that your shoes leave on the dance floor. You have the bricks of the wall. You have, and that ties to the question, energy consumption. You have the fridges that need energy. You have the DJs that fly to play a party, especially when we talk about the club culture in the global north. And maybe to wrap it up, that's also an important thing to understand. The project, it is very much located or rooted in Berlin as a starting point or as a location, but also as an idea. But it is linked to other global communities, like the history of electronic dance music, house and techno is tied to Chicago and Detroit. And it's not just a local ecosystem, but it's kind of global. And again, it also accommodates certain lifestyles where it doesn't accommodate others. And it is a question if you have the passport privilege to be able to travel and play in clubs in the global north, if you're from other places, places from the global south, for instance. All that to say, it's a big, complex ecosystem, infrastructure.
Yeah, it felt to me ethnographic, if I would put an academic method on it, which is being on the ground and having ideas emerge from people in the place and culture that you're studying. I felt listening to the episodes, the way the story worked is it almost like takes you deeper with each one. You start with these ideas that are really important and are probably some of the first crucial questions about travel, about how do you design the space. And like you said, you end up in the body, in emotions, in grief. So in a way, that was really, I think, as a listener, for people who maybe haven't thought as much about ecological politics, I also think there's an education practice there. It's about all of those things at the same time. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your choice as an ethnographer, if that word feels right to you, to not have your voice be part of those episodes and to really give them over entirely to your curators and their voices.
The question of my role came up a lot during that research, and I kind of understand it a bit as, yes, I'm an ethnographer, probably. That's, you know, the very academic term. The way I think about my practice is also being a kind of change facilitator in the different things that I'm doing, which is research, but sometimes also educational consultancy, or in the case of the podcast, a creative production. So finding different outlets to communicate topics that I find relevant and think are important to be talked about. I didn't want to make it about myself in the sense of this is the research that I've done and this is the outlet that I've chosen and I'm talking about this, but rather also platform different voices. And in the true sense, maybe of transdisciplinarity, really work across perceived boundaries of like research and, let's say, civil society. And I never felt I fit in one of these boxes. And being a kind of border crossing person, it is hard to really find this path where you're like, okay, this is the research and this is an article and I'm going to present this at a conference. Because I'm very much aware also that it is a very vulnerable cultural sphere that we are talking about. It is, especially in terms of queer nightlife, space that is very much also important for people to live identities, to explore themselves in ways that are maybe also dangerous within mainstream society and like a kind of public-facing cultural spheres that are much more regulated. So there is a form of awareness as well to how in-depth can we go without kind of exploiting, but also exposing something that has to be protected in a way and also lives in the dark, lives in the nightlife. With the three curators, they are just very much rooted within that culture. They are also DJs, they are music lovers, music nerds, And there's a connecting bond, I feel, with mutual trust. The reason why we are here and having that interview is because I realized, well, it's also a way of hiding if I'm not in there. It's a way of, oh, I'm doing this, but I let other people talk and I let other people's stories be in the forefront. And it's also a way of, well, then I don't have to be vulnerable. I don't have to be seen. But it's also nice to create that situation right now to be able to share some of the thoughts.
I think the way you've described ceding control and working with others, I can imagine that came with gifts, but also challenges, surprises.
First of all, it was great to having been able to pay everyone, and not just being able to, but that was a necessity, I felt. That was a very much a privilege of being part of that fellowship and having access to some production budget. Because I really think if we want to take transdisciplinarity seriously and want to work also with the way people outside of the university or academic system create knowledge or make sense of their world, we have to find ways of not extracting from them in a non-reciprocal way.
Yeah.
And the reciprocity is, I have the time, I have this interest. How can I ask you to share some of your time and your way of being in the world with me without maybe having that need to do that? So how can I ask you in a way that, you know, it's not just, oh, can you do me a favor because I'm interested in how you see the world, but literally almost like a commissioned artwork. And that's how I understand the participation of everyone in this project. Challenge for me would be, how can we discuss transdisciplinarity and the kind of research that is stepping outside of the purely academic bubble in a way that is creating some form of mutuality.
That really is such an important point about the value of art in general, and it connects to the first episode in my mind where they were talking about travel and saying part of it's financial, that you could have an idea of a more local or regional circuit for a DJ, but there's just, people have to live. And I think even the artist that we've met, a fellow who's a friend of ours, has talked about paying artists. I think to me, that's an important question your podcast raises, is these questions of sustainability also come with real material needs.
Absolutely. And I think that one is an important learning. It is also part of the challenge of working with people in different socio-material conditions who have to work several jobs to be able to maintain a life as a touring DJ, for instance.
So again, we have these really clear connections, I think, that you are drawing between the way that we live, the unsustainable way that we live, and how it intersects with this club culture.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe we can jump to the beginning and talk about the title.
Oh yes, the title. So as you're putting together this complicated portrait of an ecosystem and you're choosing your curators and having discussions about what will be happening with each episode, I know that you were, especially in the fall, thinking about, what would I call this? And I remember the day you came in and you said, I got it. So can you tell us the story of how this title came to you and what does it mean for you?
So the title, for everyone who is a bit confused what we're talking about, is Shifting Baselines, and baselines with a double S, so the bass. We're talking about the music instrument. And there is a interesting word play here, because in climate research, you have a syndrome that's called the shifting baseline syndrome, and base with an S and an E. Imagine you're driving in the car, and for those of you who listen and who are a bit older might remember, especially when you're on the highway, and I know that driving in a car is maybe not the most adequate reference for a podcast on sustainability, but You know, there was times when we didn't think about driving in a car maybe the same way like we do now. And you were driving and you had a lot of dead insects on the car after a journey. And that is taken as an indicator that when you drive now, you have way less insects on your car, that the normality of having a lot of insects is changing. And just talking about it, I find it really obscene almost to talk about dead insects on a car when talking about how our perception of normality of the environment changes.
I think it's a perfect example because of that.
Yeah. My go-to example is it did snow more in April while Prince was still alive. And the music lovers out there, or the Prince lovers, would get the reference. So there is changes happening. I mean, we know that that's the reason for the podcast, thinking about tipping points, thinking about planetary boundaries, socio-ecological transformation, thinking about the risk management, thinking about 1.5 degrees, Paris Agreement, thinking about how we can create a social and economically just transition where we take into account different living realities and not just the ones from our lifestyles in the global north. Thinking about the three really relevant aspects of sustainability transformation that are consistency, efficiency, and sufficiency, which actually means how can we, that's consistency, create so-called nature-friendly technologies. Efficiency, how can we use fewer resources? And then sufficiency, which I find the most relevant part also for this project, is the question of limiting our demands and how to satisfy our needs in a less consumptive way that is also thinking about the like finite resources and the idea of a dance floor as a space that is having a kind of recreational purpose that is not necessarily a space for consumption. Of course, when we talk about substance use, when we talk about how partying is also a way of how Camille frames it, doom lulls, and that kind of like hedonistic idea of the world is burning, let's have fun until it lasts. Shifting baselines is almost like a prompt or an invitation for people to participate in shifting baselines together. And I hope the podcast helps in addressing these different issues and making people think and making people curious about, oh, I haven't thought about that I can actually download music before I stream it and then it's less consumptuous or it uses less energy, or maybe I don't have to upload my DJ set, or I can take the train between bookings. And all that to say, for me, shifting baselines is very much about emotions. And my slogan through that process was emotions, not emissions. And I know that you are also really critical about our obsession with numbers and scaling. And I feel within climate research or sustainability research and communication, there is a lot of dystopian anxiety. And I feel we've reached a point, and we see that in research as well, where these numbers don't do anything anymore, or they don't translate into changing behavior. What I find really interesting about the rave is awareness. Is there awareness practices in place? Is there practices of harm reduction in place? How accessible is this? So there's this immediacy of the dance floor experience, whereas our planetary situation, the climate crisis, there's different forms of immediacy happening there, or perceived immediacy. The idea is also to bring back or to connect those issues, to not create a hierarchy of immediacies, but to understand that what I do right here, right now, and how safe I feel, how much fun I have in the party, how many new friends I make, or how exhausted I feel after, can be a kind of like metaphor for like how can I be in the world and how can I be responsible and what are the little things that I can do right here, right now to shift baselines.
Yeah, I really heard that listening to these episodes that you are exploring, that there are both dimensions of club culture that might contribute to extraction and be problematic. And at the same time, each episode points to the parts of dance that are imminent, living in the present. This line, I think, from the data episode about having a party that just lasts for the length of that party with the people who are there, and then it's gone, and sort of that experience of love. And so I think it does speak to that third point about sufficiency that you talked about, is also fulfillment, that it's not just about reducing things. It's also how do we find pleasure and how do we find community and fulfillment differently?
Yeah, absolutely. And how can we, especially in the West, relearn to be within our bodies? And that's what the last episode on emotions and grief also addresses, not having spaces for certain emotions, being used to and having been trained to suppress certain emotions, running away from them. And I think we have to really look at the emotional and psychological level of the poly crisis that we are in and dealing with trauma stored in the body, or also dealing with the over awareness of the importance of the mind in comparison to the body, and how we have to bring the body back into research and into being in the world. And that addressing the climate crisis is a very emotional topic. And this idea of wanting to hold on to a certain lifestyle because it feels threatening, you have to change something. And I feel it's such a prospect into the future. Whereas if I learn to be in the here and now in a different way, I might not feel too threatened when things are changing. And it comes with an ability to hold space for transformation. And I know that people have different abilities or also different ways of dealing with that. But in general, maybe trying to be a bit kinder to ourselves and to one another, because we all don't know, in a way. We don't have like a big plan of how this world looks in 50 years. But we have to, and I'm very clear about that, we have to take science and research seriously. And at the same time, we have to find ways of dealing with this in a way that is digestible or doable for us as humans. Because it's quite overwhelming, and we are anyway super overwhelmed with so much data, so much information. At the end of the day, I always say we are mammals. And, you know, we are rational. And that's great. We can think about our actions. We can reflect. We can have ethics. We can have morals. And we should. And we should have conversations about that. We should discuss it. We should argue about it. We should find common ground. And I think we find it in also through messiness and through conflict. And if we learn to be in that messiness and in conflict, also with ourselves and with difficult emotions, I really believe that that could lead into more connectedness and lead to a different way of paying attention to not just our health, but also planetary health.
Right. Having a way to process difficult emotions in the body and not just repress them or rationalize them. Shifting baselines, being less part of the exhaustive wheel of work and overwork and ambitions and goals. I mean, the way that this kind of constant growth happens at a macroeconomic level also happens at the level of our bodies and our need to have our own kind of plan of exponential improvement always. So I really see part of how you're living your own life and your own intellectual journey as the really scary but also courageous way of making your own path and trying to do something different than that.
That's a beautiful ending. And before we end, I will say thank you to Nono Gigsta, who curated and narrated episode 1 on space and mobility. Also to Sarge Lynch, who curated and narrated episode 2 on data and digitalization, and Camille Sapara-Barton, who curated and narrated episode 3 on emotions, bodies, and especially grief, as well as Yuya Flaskina for the amazing sound design, and Upashona Ghosh for the artwork, and Saverio Cantoni for supporting and creating access, and Sarah Farina for supporting with editing all episodes. And maybe one last word to that question of going on new paths or kind of forging your own. The visuals are a form of translation of that, thinking about desire lines. And desire lines, for those of you who have never heard of this, are the little footpaths that people create just crossing a little grass patch or whatever because it's a shortcut, for instance. Or it's, that's why it's called desire line, following a desire of walking in a different way. And I think the desire lines are a beautiful symbol of the baselines and the shifting baselines, and also a reason why we haven't chosen music in the podcast. One was very pragmatic because it would have increased the costs a lot to work with recorded music, but also to give space for the sound design to really grasp this idea of talking about the ephemeral experience of being on a dance floor and raving and that really relevant cultural sphere, but dissecting it and not using music as a literal translation or almost illustration, but to play with how can we be embodied and on the dance floor, but at the same time in a distance because we are talking and reflecting about it. And the sound design is a form of translation of that distance. And it's very beautiful idea of looking at it that Yuya, the sound designer, has created.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and it was a real pleasure to hear more about this, and congratulations to you and all the curators.
Thank you, Kara.
Is there anything else you really want to say?
There's just one more thing to everyone listening. I hope you feel inspired while listening, and please be gentle with yourself, or the topics can be quite hard. They can feel challenging or difficult, so take breaks when needed, or have a dance, play a song if this is available to you, or drink some water. Just in a way, take care of yourself.
Or have your friend make you coffee. Kirsten made me a beautiful cup of coffee.
Or that. If you're around friends. Or collaborative listening. And let us know what you think. Thank you, Kara.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Shifting Baselines. Idea, concept, and creative production. Kerstin Meissner is part of her research fellowship at the Research Institute for Sustainability, Helmholtz Center, Potsdam. Sound design and composition, Yuya Flaskina. Editing, Sarah Farina. Artwork, Upashona Ghosh. Accessibility support, Saverio Cantoni. Mixing and mastering, Yuya Flaskina. Support and Financial Administration, Research Institute for Sustainability, Helmholtz Center Potsdam, especially Achim Maas. Broadcasting and Publication, Refuge Worldwide.
Shifting baselines. Shifting baselines.